Tender is the Night, Disc 6.
6. It was May when he next found her. The luncheon in Zurich was a council of caution. Obviously, the logic of his life tended away from the girl, yet when a stranger stared at her from a nearby table, eyes burning disturbingly like an uncharted light, he turned to the man with an urbane version of intimidation and broke the regard. "He was just a peeper," he explained cheerfully. "He was just looking at your clothes. Why do you have so many different clothes?" "Sister says we're very rich," she offered humbly, "since grandmother is dead." "I forgive you." He was enough older than Nicole to take pleasure in her youthful vanities and delights, the way she paused fractionally in front of the hall mirror on leaving the restaurant, so that the incorruptible Quicksilver could give her back to herself. He delighted in her stretching out her hands to new octaves now that she found herself beautiful and rich. He tried honestly to divorce her from any obsession that he had stitched her together, glad to see her build up happiness and confidence apart from him. The difficulty was that, eventually, Nicole brought everything to his feet. Gifts of sacrificial ambrosia, of worshipping myrtle. The first week of summer found Dick re-established in Zurich. He had arranged his pamphlets and what work he had done in the service into a pattern from which he intended to make his revise of A Psychology for Psychiatrists. He thought he had a publisher. He had established contact with a poor student who would iron out his errors in German. Franz considered it a rash business, but Dick pointed out the disarming modesty of the theme. "This is stuff I'll never know so well again," he insisted. "I have a hunch it's a thing that only fails to be basic because it's never had material recognition. The weakness of this profession is its attraction for the man a little crippled and broken. Within the walls of the profession, he compensates by tending toward the clinical, the practical. He has won his battle without a struggle. On the contrary, you are a good man, Franz, because fate selected you for your profession before you were born. You better thank God you had no bent. I got to be a psychiatrist because there was a girl at St. Hilda's in Oxford that went to the same lectures. Maybe I'm getting trite, but I don't want to let my current ideas slide away with a few dozen glasses of beer." "All right," Franz answered. "You are an American. You can do this without professional harm. I do not like these generalities. Soon you will be writing little books called Deep Thoughts for the Layman, so simplified that they are positively guaranteed not to cause thinking. If my father were alive, he would look at you and grunt, Dick. He would take his napkin and fold it so, and hold his napkin ring, this very one," he held it up, a boar's head was carved in the brown wood, "and he would say, 'Well, my impression is—' then he would look at you and think suddenly, 'What is the use?' Then he would stop and grunt again. Then we would be at the end of dinner." "I am alone today," said Dick testily, "but I may not be alone tomorrow. After that I'll fold up my napkin like your father and grunt." Franz waited a moment. "How about our patient?" he asked. "I don't know." "Well, you should know about her by now. I like her. She's attractive." "What do you want me to do, take her up in the Edelweiss?" "No. I thought since you go in for scientific books, you might have an idea." "Devote my life to her?" Franz called his wife in the kitchen. "Du lieber Gott, bitte, bringe Dick noch ein Glas Bier. I don't want any more if I've got to see Daumler. We think it's best to have a program. 4 weeks have passed away. Apparently the girl is in love with you. That's not our business if we were in the world, but here in the clinic we have a stake in the matter." "I'll do whatever Dr. Daumler says," Dick agreed. But he had little faith that Daumler would throw much light on the matter. He himself was the incalculable element involved. By no conscious volition of his own, the thing had drifted into his hands. It reminded him of a scene in his childhood when everyone in the house was looking for the lost key to the silver closet, Dick knowing he had hid it under the handkerchiefs in his mother's top drawer. At that time he had experienced a philosophical detachment, and this was repeated now when he and Franz went together to Professor Daumler's office. The professor, his face beautiful under straight whiskers, like a vine-overgrown veranda of some fine old house, disarmed him. Dick knew some individuals with more talent, but no person of a class qualitatively superior to Daumler. 6 months later he thought the same way when he saw Daumler dead, the light out on the veranda, the vines of his whiskers tickling his stiff white collar, the many battles that had swayed before the chink-like eyes stilled forever under the frail, delicate lids. "Good morning, sir," he stood formally, thrown back to the army. Professor Daumler interlaced his tranquil fingers. Franz spoke in terms half of liaison officer, half of secretary, till his senior cut through him in mid-sentence.
"We have gone a certain way," he said mildly. "It's you, Dr. Diver, who can best help us now."
"Rout it out," Dick confessed. "I'm not so straight on it myself."
"I have nothing to do with your personal reactions," said Daumler. "But I have much to do with the fact that this so-called transference," he darted a short, ironic look at Franz, which the latter returned in kind, "must be terminated. Miss Nicole does well indeed, but she is in no condition to survive what she might interpret as a tragedy."
Again Franz began to speak, but Dr. Daumler motioned him silent. "I realize that your position has been difficult."
"Yes, it has."
Now the professor sat back and laughed, saying on the last syllable of his laughter, with his sharp little gray eyes shining through, "Perhaps you have got sentimentally involved yourself." Aware that he was being drawn on, Dick, too, laughed. "She's a pretty girl. Anybody responds to that to a certain extent. I have no intention—" Again Franz tried to speak. Again Daumler stopped him with a question directed pointedly at Dick. "Have you thought of going away?"
"I can't go away."
Dr. Daumler turned to Franz.
"Then we can send Miss Warren away."
"As you think best, Professor Daumler," Dick conceded. "It's certainly a situation." Professor Daumler raised himself like a legless man mounting a pair of crutches.
"But it is a professional situation," he cried quietly.
He sighed himself back into his chair, waiting for the reverberating thunder to die out about the room. Dick saw that Daumler had reached his climax, and he was not sure that he himself had survived it. When the thunder had diminished, Franz managed to get his word in. "Dr. Diver is a man of fine character," he said. "I feel he only has to appreciate the situation in order to deal correctly with it. In my opinion, Dick can cooperate right here without anyone going away."
"How do you feel about that?"
Professor Daumler asked Dick. Dick felt churlish in the face of the situation. At the same time, he realized, in the silence after Daumler's pronouncement, that the state of inanimation could not be indefinitely prolonged. Suddenly, he spilled everything. "I'm half in love with her. The question of marrying her has passed through my mind," uttered Franz.
"Wait,"
Daumler warned him. Franz refused to wait. "What, and devote half your life to being doctor and nurse and all? Never! I know what these cases are. 1 time in 20, it's finished in the first push. Better never see her again."
"What do you think?" Daumler asked Dick.
"Of course, Franz is right." Seven. It was late afternoon when they wound up the discussion as to what Dick should do. He must be most kind and yet eliminate himself. When the doctors stood up at last, Dick's eyes fell outside the window to where a light rain was falling. Nicole was waiting, expectant, somewhere in that rain. When presently he went out, buttoning his oilskin at the throat, pulling down the brim of his hat, he came upon her immediately under the roof of the main entrance. "I know a new place we can go," she said. "When I was ill, I didn't mind sitting inside with the others in the evening. What they said seemed like everything else. Naturally, now I see them as ill, and it's... You'll be leaving soon." "Oh, soon. My sister, Beth, but she's always been called Baby. She's coming in a few weeks to take me somewhere. After that, I'll be back here for a last month." "The older sister?" "Oh, quite a bit older. She's 24. She's very English. She lives in London with my father's sister. She was engaged to an Englishman, but he was killed. I never saw him." Her face, ivory gold against the blurred sunset that strove through the rain, had a promise Dick had never seen before. The high cheekbones, the faintly wan quality, cool rather than feverish, was reminiscent of the frame of a promising colt. A creature whose life did not promise to be only a projection of youth upon a grayer screen, but instead a true growing. The face would be handsome in middle life. It would be handsome in old age. The essential structure and the economy were there. "What are you looking at?" "I was just thinking that you're going to be rather happy." Nicole was frightened. "Am I? All right. Things couldn't be worse than they have been." In the covered woodshed to which she had led him, she sat cross-legged upon her golf shoes, her Burberry wound about her and her cheeks stung alive by the damp air. Gravely she returned his gaze, taking in his somewhat proud carriage that never quite yielded to the wooden post against which he leaned. She looked into his face that always tried to discipline itself into molds of attentive seriousness, after excursions into joys and mockeries of its own. That part of him which seemed to fit his reddish Irish colouring she knew least. She was afraid of it, yet more anxious to explore. This was his more masculine side. The other part, the trained part, the consideration in the polite eyes, she expropriated without question, as most women did. "At least this institution has been good for languages," said Nicole. "I've spoken French with two doctors, and German with the nurses, and Italian, or something like it, with a couple of scrubwomen and one of the patients, and I've picked up a lot of Spanish from another." "That's fine." He tried to arrange an attitude, but no logic seemed forthcoming. "Music, too. Hope you didn't think I was only interested in ragtime. I practice every day. The last few months I've been taking a course in Zurich on the history of music. In fact, it was all that kept me going at times, music and the drawing." She leaned suddenly and twisted a loose strip from the sole of her shoe and then looked up. "I'd like to draw you, just the way you are now." It made him sad when she brought out her accomplishments for his approval. "I envy you. At present I don't seem to be interested in anything except my work." "Oh, I think that's fine for a man," she said quickly. "But for a girl I think she ought to have lots of minor accomplishments and pass them on to her children." "I suppose so," said Dick, with deliberated indifference. Nicole sat quiet. Dick wished she would speak so that he could play the easy role of wet blanket. But now she sat quiet. "You're all well," he said. "Try to forget the past. Don't overdo things for a year or so. Go back to America and be a debutante and fall in love, and be happy." "I couldn't fall in love." Her injured shoe scraped a cocoon of dust from the log on which she sat. "Sure you can," Dick insisted.
Not for a year, maybe, but sooner or later. Then he added, brutally, "You can have a perfectly normal life with a house full of beautiful descendants. The very fact that you could make a complete comeback at your age proves that the precipitating factors were pretty near everything. Young woman, you'll be pulling your weight long after your friends are carried off screaming." But there was a look of pain in her eyes as she took the rough dose, the harsh reminder. "I know I wouldn't be fit to marry anyone for a long time," she said humbly. Dick was too upset to say any more. He looked out into the grain field, trying to recover his hard, brassy attitude. "You'll be all right. Everybody here believes in you. Why, Dr. Gregory is so proud of you that he'll probably—" "I hate Dr. Gregory." "Well, you shouldn't." Nicole's world had fallen to pieces, but it was only a flimsy and scarcely created world. Beneath it, her emotions and instincts fought on. Was it an hour ago she had waited by the entrance, wearing her hope like a corsage at her belt? Dress stay crisp for him, button stay put, bloom narcissus, air stay still and sweet. "It would be nice to have fun again," she fumbled on. For a moment she entertained a desperate idea of telling him how rich she was, what big houses she lived in, that really she was a valuable property. For a moment she made herself into her grandfather, Sid Warren, the horse trader. But she survived the temptation to confuse all values and shut these matters into their Victorian side chambers, even though there was no home left to her, save emptiness and pain. "I have to go back to the clinic. It's not raining now." Dick walked beside her, feeling her unhappiness, and wanting to drink the rain that touched her cheek. "I have some new records," she said. "I can hardly wait to play them. Do you know..." After supper that evening, Dick thought, he would finish the break. Also, he wanted to kick Franz's bottom for having partially introduced him to such a sordid business. He waited in the hall. His eyes followed a beret, not wet with waiting like Nicole's beret, but covering a skull recently operated on. Beneath it, human eyes peered, found him, and came over.
"Bonjour, docteur."
"Bonjour, monsieur.
Il fait bon temps."
"Oui, merveilleux.
Vous êtes ici maintenant?"
"Non, pour la journée seulement."
"Ah, bon. Alors, au revoir, monsieur."
Glad at having survived another contact, the wretch in the beret moved away. Dick waited. Presently a nurse came downstairs and delivered him a message.
"Miss Warren asks to be excused, doctor. She wants to lie down. She wants to have dinner upstairs tonight."
The nurse hung on his response, half expecting him to imply that Miss Warren's attitude was pathological.
"Oh, I see. Well..."
He rearranged the flow of his own saliva, the pulse of his heart.
"I hope she feels better. Thanks."
He was puzzled and discontent. At any rate, it freed him. Leaving a note for Franz begging off from supper, he walked through the countryside to the tram station. As he reached the platform, with spring twilight gilding the rails and the glass in the slot machines, he began to feel that the station, a hospital, was hovering between being centripetal and centrifugal. He felt frightened. He was glad when the substantial cobblestones of Zurich clicked once more under his shoes. He expected to hear from Nicole next day, but there was no word. Wondering if she was ill, he called the clinic and talked to Franz.
"She came downstairs to luncheon yesterday and today," said Franz. "She seemed a little abstracted and in the clouds. How did it go off?"
Dick tried to plunge over the alpine crevasse between the sexes. We didn't get to it. At least I didn't think we did. I tried to be distant, but I didn't think enough happened to change her attitude if it ever went deep. Perhaps his vanity had been hurt that there was no coup de grace to administer. From some things she said to her nurse, I'm inclined to think she understood. All right. It was the best thing that could have happened. She doesn't seem over-agitated, only a little in the clouds. All right, then. Dick, come soon and see me. 8. During the next weeks, Dick experienced a vast dissatisfaction. The pathological origin and mechanistic defeat of the affair left a flat and metallic taste. Nicole's emotions had been used unfairly. What if they turned out to have been his own? Necessarily, he must absent himself from Felicity a while. In dreams, he saw her walking on the clinic path, swinging her wide straw hat. One time he saw her in person. As he walked past the Palace Hotel, a magnificent Rolls curved into the half-moon entrance. Small within its gigantic proportions, and buoyed up by the power of 100 superfluous horses, sat Nicole and a young woman, whom he assumed was her sister. Nicole saw him, and momentarily her lips parted in an expression of fright. Dick shifted his hat and passed, yet for a moment the air around him was loud with the circlings of all the goblins on the Grossmünster. He tried to write the matter out of his mind in a memorandum that went into detail as to the solemn regime before her. The possibilities of another push of the malady under the stresses which the world would inevitably supply. In all, a memorandum that would have been convincing to anyone, save to him who had written it. The total value of this effort was to make him realize once more how far his emotions were involved. Thenceforth he resolutely provided antidotes. One was the telephone girl from Bar-sur-Aube, now touring Europe from Nice to Koblenz, in a desperate roundup of the men she had known in her never-to-be-equaled holiday. Another was the making of arrangements to get home on a government transport in August. A third was a consequent intensification of work on his proofs for the book that this autumn was to be presented to the German-speaking world of psychiatry. Dick had outgrown the book. He wanted now to do more spade work. If he got an exchange fellowship, he could count on plenty of routine. Meanwhile, he had projected a new work. An attempt at a uniform and pragmatic classification of the neuroses and psychoses based on an examination of 1,500 pre-Krapalin and post-Krapalin cases as they would be diagnosed in the terminology of the different contemporary schools. And another sonorous paragraph, together with a chronology of such subdivisions of opinion as have arisen independently. This title would look monumental in German. Ein Versuch, die Neurosen und Psychosen gleichmäßig und pragmatisch zu klassifizieren aufgrund der Untersuchung von 1500 Prä-Krapelin und Post-Krapelin-Fällen, wie sie diagnostiert sein würden, in der Terminologie von den verschiedenen Schulen der Gegenwart. And another sonorous paragraph. Zusammen mit einer Chronologie solcher Subdivisionen der Meinung, welche unabhängig entstanden sind. Going into Montreux, Dick pedaled slowly, gaping at the Jugendhorn whenever possible, and blinded by glimpses of the lake through the alleys of the shore hotels. He was conscious of the groups of English, emergent after 4 years and walking with detective story suspicion in their eyes, as though they were about to be assaulted in this questionable country by German-trained bands. There were building and awakening everywhere on this mound of debris formed by a mountain torrent,
At Bern and at Lausanne, on the way south, Dick had been eagerly asked if there would be Americans this year. By August, if not in June? He wore leather shorts, an army shirt, mountain shoes. In his knapsack were a cotton suit and a change of underwear. At the Glion funicular, he checked his bicycle and took a small beer on the terrace of the station buffet, meanwhile watching the little bug crawl down the 80-degree slope of the hill. His ear was full of dried blood from La Tour de Peltz, where he had sprinted under the impression that he was a spoiled athlete. He asked for alcohol and cleared up the exterior while the funicular slid down port. He saw his bicycle embarked, slung his knapsack into the lower compartment of the car, and followed it in. Mountain-climbing cars are built on a slant similar to the angle of a hat brim of a man who doesn't want to be recognized. As water gushed from the chamber under the car, Dick was impressed with the ingenuity of the whole idea. A complimentary car was now taking on mountain water at the top and would pull the lightened car up by gravity as soon as the brakes were released. It must have been a great inspiration. In the seat across, a couple of British were discussing the cable itself. "The ones made in England always last 5 or 6 years. 2 years ago the Germans underbid us, and how long do you think their cable lasted?"
"How long?"
"A year and 10 months. Then the Swiss sold it to the Italians. They don't have rigid inspections of cables."
"I can see it would be a terrible thing for Switzerland if a cable broke."
The conductor shut a door. He telephoned his confrère among the undulati, and with a jerk the car was pulled upward, heading for a pinpoint on an emerald hill above. After it cleared the low roofs, the skies of Vaud, Valais, Swiss Savoy, and Geneva spread around the passengers in cyclorama. On the center of the lake, cooled by the piercing current of the Rhone, lay the true center of the Western world. Upon it floated swans like boats, and boats like swans, both lost in the nothingness of the heartless beauty. It was a bright day, with sun glittering on the grass beach below, and the white courts of the Kursaal. The figures in the courts threw no shadows. When Chillon and the island palace of Salagnon came into view, Dick turned his eyes inward. The funicular was above the highest houses of the shore. On both sides, a tangle of foliage and flowers culminated at intervals in masses of color. It was a railside garden, and in the car was a sign, "Défense de cueillir les fleurs." Though one must not pick flowers on the way up, the blossoms trailed in as they passed. Dorothy Perkins' roses dragged patiently through each compartment, slowly waggling with the motion of the funicular, letting go at the last to swing back to their rosy cluster. Again and again these branches went through the car. In the compartment above and in front of Dick's, a group of English were standing up and exclaiming upon the backdrop of sky when suddenly there was a confusion among them. They parted to give passage to a couple of young people who made apologies and scrambled over into the rear compartment of the funicular, Dick's compartment. The young man was a Latin with the eyes of a stuffed deer. The girl was Nicole. The two climbers gasped momentarily from their efforts. As they settled into seats, laughing and crowding the English to the corners, Nicole said, "Hello!" She was lovely to look at. Immediately Dick saw that something was different. In a second he realized it was her fine spun hair, bobbed like Irene Castle's and fluffed into curls. She wore a sweater of powder blue and a white tennis skirt. She was the first morning in May, and every taint of the clinic was departed. "Plunk!" she gasped. "Ooh, that guard! They'll arrest us at the next stop. Dr. Diver, the Comte de Marmara." "Gee, Imini!" She felt her new hair, panting. "Sister bought first-class tickets. It's a matter of principle with her." She and Marmara exchanged glances and shouted.
Then we found that first class is the hearse part behind the chauffeur, shut in with curtains for a rainy day so you can't see anything. But sister's very dignified.
Again Nicole and Marmora laughed, with young intimacy. "Where you bound?" asked Dick.
"Co.
You too?"
Nicole looked at his costume. "That your bicycle they got up in front?"
"Yes, I'm going to coast down Monday. With me on your handlebars. I mean, really, will you? I can't think of more fun."
"But I will carry you down in my arms," Marmora protested intensely. "I will roller skate you, or I will throw you and you will fall slowly like a feather."
The delight in Nicole's face, to be a feather again instead of a plummet, to float and not to drag. She was a carnival to watch, at times primly coy, posing, grimacing, and gesturing. Sometimes the shadow fell and the dignity of old suffering flowed down into her fingertips. Dick wished himself away from her, fearing that he was a reminder of a world well left behind. He resolved to go to the other hotel. When the funicular came to rest, those new to it stirred in suspension between the blues of two heavens. It was merely for a mysterious exchange between the conductor of the car going up and the conductor of the car coming down. Then up and up over a forest path and a gorge, then again up a hill that became solid with narcissus from passengers to sky. The people in Montreux playing tennis in the lakeside courts were pinpoints now. Something new was in the air. Freshness. Freshness embodying itself in music as the car slid into Glion and they heard the orchestra in the hotel garden. When they changed to the mountain train, the music was drowned by the rushing water released from the hydraulic chamber. Almost overhead was Co, where the thousand windows of a hotel burned in the late sun. But the approach was different. A leather-lunged engine pushed the passengers round and round in a corkscrew, mounting, rising. They chugged through low-level clouds, and for a moment Dick lost Nicole's face in the spray of the slanting donkey engine. They skirted a lost streak of wind, with the hotel growing in size at each spiral, until with a vast surprise they were there, on top of the sunshine. In the confusion of arrival, as Dick slung his knapsack and started forward on the platform to get his bicycle, Nicole was beside him. "Aren't you at our hotel?" she asked. "I'm economizing. Will you come down and have dinner?" Some confusion with baggage ensued. "This is my sister, Dr. Diver from Zurich." Dick bowed to a young woman of 25, tall and confident. She was both formidable and vulnerable, he decided, remembering other women with flower-like mouths, grooved for bits. "I'll drop in after dinner," Dick promised. "First, I must get acclimated." He wheeled off his bicycle, feeling Nicole's eyes following him, feeling her helpless first love, feeling it twist around inside him. He went 300 yards up the slope to the other hotel. He engaged a room and found himself washing without a memory of the intervening 10 minutes. Only a sort of drunken flush pierced with voices, unimportant voices, that did not know how much he was loved. Nine. They were waiting for him, and incomplete without him. He was still the incalculable element. Miss Warren and the young Italian wore their anticipation as obviously as Nicole. The salon of the hotel, a room of fabled acoustics, was stripped for dancing, but there was a small gallery of English women of a certain age, with neck bands, dyed hair, and faces powdered pinkish-gray, and of American women of a certain age, with snowy white transformations, black dresses, and lips of cherry red. Miss Warren and Marmara were at a corner table. Nicole was diagonally across from them, 40 yards away, and as Dick arrived, he heard her voice.
"Can you hear me? I'm speaking naturally."
"Perfectly.
Hello, Dr. Diver."
"What's this?"
"You realize the people in the center of the floor can't hear what I say, but you can."
"A waiter told us about it," said Miss Warren. "Corner to corner, it's like wireless." It was exciting up on the mountain, like a ship at sea. Presently Marmara's parents joined them. They treated the Warrens with respect. Dick gathered that their fortunes had something to do with a bank in Milan that had something to do with the Warren fortunes. But baby Warren wanted to talk to Dick, wanted to talk to him with the impetus that sent her out vagrantly toward all new men, as though she were on an inelastic tether, and considered that she might as well get to the end of it as soon as possible. She crossed and recrossed her knees frequently in the manner of tall, restless virgins. "Nicole told me that you took part care of her, and had a lot to do with her getting well. What I can't understand is what we're supposed to do. They were so indefinite at the sanitarium. They only told me she ought to be natural and gay. I knew the Marmaras were up here, so I asked Tino to meet us at the funicular. And you see what happens. The very first thing, Nicole has him crawling over the sides of the car as if they were both insane." "That was absolutely normal," Dick laughed. "I'd call it a good sign. They were showing off for each other." "But how can I tell? Before I knew it, almost in front of my eyes, she had her hair cut off in Zurich because of a picture in Vanity Fair." "That's all right. She's a schizoid, a permanent eccentric. You can't change that."
"What is it?"
"Just what I said, an eccentric."
"Well, how can anyone tell what's eccentric and what's crazy?"
"Nothing is going to be crazy. Nicole is all fresh and happy. You needn't be afraid." Baby shifted her knees about. She was a compendium of all the discontented women who had loved Byron 100 years before. Yet, in spite of the tragic affair with the guard's officer, there was something wooden and onanistic about her.
"I don't mind the responsibility," she declared. "But I'm in the air. We've never had anything like this in the family before. We know Nicole had some shock, and my opinion is it was about a boy, but we don't really know. Father says he would have shot him if he could have found out."
The orchestra was playing Poor Butterfly. Young Marmara was dancing with his mother. It was a tune new enough to them all. Listening and watching Nicole's shoulders as she chattered to the elder Marmara, whose hair was dashed with white like a piano keyboard, Dick thought of the shoulders of a violin. And then he thought of the dishonor, the secret. Oh, Butterfly, the moments pass into hours.
"Actually, I have a plan," Baby continued with apologetic hardness. "It may seem absolutely impractical to you, but they say Nicole will need to be looked after for a few years. I don't know whether you know Chicago or not."
"I don't."
"Well, there's a north side and a south side, and they're very much separated. The north side is chic and all that, and we've always lived over there, at least for many years, but lots of old families, old Chicago families, if you know what I mean, still live on the south side. The university is there. I mean, it's stuffy to some people, but anyhow, it's different from the north side." "I don't know whether you understand."
He nodded. With some concentration, he had been able to follow her.
"Now, of course, we have lots of connections there. Father controls certain chairs and fellowships and so forth at the university. And I thought if we took Nicole home and threw her with that crowd— you see, she's quite musical and speaks all these languages. What could be better in her condition than if she fell in love with some good doctor?"
A burst of hilarity surged up in Dick. The Warrens were going to buy Nicole a doctor.
You got a nice doctor you can let us use?" There was no use worrying about Nicole when they were in the position of being able to buy her a nice young doctor, the paint scarcely dry on him. "But how about the doctor?" he said automatically. "There must be many who'd jump at the chance." The dancers were back, but Baby whispered quickly, "This is the sort of thing I mean. Now where is Nicole? She's gone off somewhere. Is she upstairs in her room? What am I supposed to do? I never know whether it's something innocent or whether I ought to go find her." "Perhaps she just wants to be by herself. People living alone get used to loneliness." Seeing that Miss Warren was not listening, he stopped. "I'll take a look around." For a moment, all the outdoors shut in with mist was like spring with the curtains drawn. Life was gathered near the hotel. Dick passed some cellar windows where bus boys sat on bunks and played cards over a liter of Spanish wine. As he approached the promenade, the stars began to come through the white crests of the high Alps. On the horseshoe walk overlooking the lake, Nicole was the figure motionless between two lampstands, and he approached silently across the grass. She turned to him with an expression of, "Here you are," and for a moment he was sorry he had come. "Your sister wondered." "Oh!" She was accustomed to being watched. With an effort, she explained herself. "Sometimes I get a little... it gets a little too much. I've lived so quietly. Tonight that music was too much. It made me want to cry." "I understand. This has been an awfully exciting day." "I know. I don't want to do anything antisocial. I've caused everybody enough trouble, but tonight I wanted to get away." It occurred to Dick suddenly, as it might occur to a dying man that he had forgotten to tell where his will was, that Nicole had been re-educated by Daumler and the ghostly generations behind him. It occurred to him also that there would be so much she would have to be told. But having recorded this wisdom within himself, he yielded to the insistent face value of the situation and said, "You're a nice person. Just keep using your own judgment about yourself." "You like me?" "Of course." "Would you?" They were strolling along toward the dim end of the horseshoe, 200 yards ahead. "If I hadn't been sick, would you... I mean, would I have been the sort of girl you might have... Oh, slush, you know what I mean." He was in for it now, possessed by a vast irrationality. She was so near that he felt his breathing change, but again his training came to his aid in a boy's laugh and a trite remark. "You're teasing yourself, my dear. Once I knew a man who fell in love with his nurse." The anecdote rambled on, punctuated by their footsteps. Suddenly, Nicole interrupted in succinct Chicagoese. "Bull." "That's a very vulgar expression." "What about it?" she flared up. "You don't think I've got any common sense. Before I was sick, I didn't have any, but I have now. And if I don't know you're the most attractive man I ever met, you must think I'm still crazy. It's my hard luck, all right, but don't pretend I don't know. I know everything about you and me." Dick was at an additional disadvantage. He remembered the statement of the elder Miss Warren as to the young doctors that could be purchased in the intellectual stockyards of the south side of Chicago. And he hardened for a moment. "You're a fetching kid, but I couldn't fall in love." "You won't give me a chance." "What?" The impertinence, the right to invade implied, astounded him. Short of anarchy, he could not think of any chance that Nicole Warren deserved. "Give me a chance now." The voice fell low, sank into her breast, and stretched the tight bodice over her heart as she came up close. He felt the young lips, her body sighing in relief against the arm growing stronger to hold her. There were now no more plans than if Dick had arbitrarily made some indissoluble mixture, with atoms joined and inseparable. You could throw it all out, but never again could they fit back into atomic scale. As he held her, and tasted her, and as she curved in further and further toward him, with her own lips, new to herself, drowned and engulfed in love, yet solaced and triumphant, he was thankful to have an existence at all, if only as a reflection in her wet eyes. "My God," he gasped, "you're fun to kiss." That was talk, but Nicole had a better hold on him now, and she held it. She turned coquette and walked away, leaving him as suspended as in the funicular of the afternoon. She felt, there, that'll show him, how conceited, how he could do with me. Oh, wasn't it wonderful? I've got him. He's mine. Now in the sequence came flight, but it was all so sweet and new that she dawdled, wanting to draw all of it in. She shivered suddenly. 2,000 feet below, she saw the necklace and bracelet of lights that were Montreux and Vevey. Beyond them, a dim pendant of Lausanne. From down there, somewhere, ascended a faint sound of dance music. Nicole was up in her head now, cool as cool, trying to collate the sentimentalities of her childhood, as deliberate as a man getting drunk after battle. But she was still afraid of Dick, who stood near her, leaning, characteristically, against the iron fence that rimmed the horseshoe. And this prompted her to say, "I can remember how I stood waiting for you in the garden, holding all myself in my arms like a basket of flowers. It was that to me, anyhow. I thought I was sweet, waiting to hand that basket to you." He breathed over her shoulder and turned her insistently about. She kissed him several times, her face getting big every time she came close, her hands holding him by the shoulders. "It's raining hard." Suddenly there was a booming from the wine slopes across the lake. Cannons were shooting at hail-bearing clouds in order to break them. The lights of the promenade went off, went on again. Then the storm came swiftly, first falling from the heavens, then doubly falling in torrents from the mountains and washing loud down the roads and stone ditches. With it came a dark, frightening sky, and savage filaments of lightning and world-splitting thunder, while ragged, destroying clouds fled along past the hotel. Mountains and lake disappeared. The hotel crouched amid tumult, chaos, and darkness. By this time, Dick and Nicole had reached the vestibule, where Baby Warren and the three Marmoras were anxiously awaiting them. It was exciting coming out of the wet fog, with the doors banging, to stand and laugh and quiver with emotion, wind in their ears and rain on their clothes. Now in the ballroom the orchestra was playing a Strauss waltz, high and confusing. For Dr. Diver to marry a mental patient, how did it happen? Where did it begin? "Won't you come back after you've changed?" Baby Warren asked after a close scrutiny. "I haven't got any change, except some shorts." As he trudged up to his hotel in a borrowed raincoat, he kept laughing derisively in his throat. "Big chance, oh yes. My God, they decided to buy a doctor? Well, they better stick to whoever they've got in Chicago."
Revolted by his harshness, he made amends to Nicole, remembering that nothing had ever felt so young as her lips. Remembering rain like tears shed for him that lay upon her softly shining porcelain cheeks. The silence of the storm, ceasing, woke him about 3 o'clock, and he went to the window. Her beauty climbed the rolling slope. It came into the room, rustling ghost-like through the curtains. He climbed 2,000 meters to Rocher de Nez the following morning, amused by the fact that his conductor of the day before was using his day off to climb also. Then Dick descended all the way to Montreux for a swim, got back to his hotel in time for dinner. 2 notes awaited him. I'm not ashamed about last night. It was the nicest thing that ever happened to me, and even if I never saw you again, mon capitaine, I would be glad it happened. That was disarming enough. The heavy shade of Domna retreated as Dick opened the second envelope. Dear Dr. Diver, I phoned, but you were out. I wonder if I may ask you a great big favor. Unforeseen circumstances call me back to Paris, and I find I can make better time by way of Lausanne. Can you let Nicole ride as far as Zurich with you, since you are going back Monday, and drop her at the sanitarium? Is this too much to ask? Sincerely, Beth Evan Warren. Dick was furious. Miss Warren had known he had a bicycle with him, yet she had so phrased her note that it was impossible to refuse. Throw us together. Sweet propinquity, and the Warren money. He was wrong. Baby Warren had no such intentions. She had looked Dick over with worldly eyes. She had measured him with the warped rule of an Anglophile and found him wanting, in spite of the fact that she found him toothsome. But for her he was too intellectual, and she pigeonholed him with a shabby, snobby crowd she had once known in London. He put himself out too much to be really of the correct stuff. She could not see how he could be made into her idea of an aristocrat. In addition to that, he was stubborn. She had seen him leave her conversation and get down behind his eyes in that odd way that people did 6 times. She had not liked Nicole's free and easy manner as a child, and now she was sensibly habituated to thinking of her as a gone coon. And anyhow, Dr. Diver was not the sort of medical man she could envisage in the family. She only wanted to use him, innocently, as a convenience. But her request had the effect that Dick assumed she desired. A ride in a train can be a terrible, heavy-hearted, or comic thing. It can be a trial flight. It can be a prefiguration of another journey, just as a given day with a friend can be long, from the taste of hurry in the morning up to the realization of both being hungry and taking food together. Then comes the afternoon, with the journey fading and dying, but quickening again at the end. Dick was sad to see Nicole's meager joy, yet it was a relief for her going back to the only home she knew. They made no love that day, but when he left her outside the sad door on the Zurichsee, and she turned and looked at him, he knew her problem was one they had together, for good now. Ten. In Zurich in September, Dr. Diver had tea with Baby Warren. "I think it's ill-advised," she said. "I'm not sure I truly understand your motives." "Don't let's be unpleasant. After all, I'm Nicole's sister. That doesn't give you the right to be unpleasant." It irritated Dick that he knew so much that he could not tell her. "Nicole's rich, but that doesn't make me an adventurer." "That's just it," complained Baby, stubbornly. "Nicole's rich."
"Just how much money has she got?" he asked.
She started, and with a silent laugh, he continued. "You see how silly this is.
I'd rather talk to some man in your family. Everything's been left to me, she persisted. It isn't we think you're an adventurer. We don't know who you are.
I'm a doctor of medicine, he said. My father is a clergyman, now retired. We lived in Buffalo, and my past is open to investigation. I went to New Haven. Afterward, I was a Rhodes Scholar. My great-grandfather was governor of North Carolina, and I'm a direct descendant of Mad Anthony Wayne.
Who was Mad Anthony Wayne? Baby asked suspiciously.
Mad Anthony Wayne?
I think there's enough madness in this affair.
He shook his head hopelessly, just as Nicole came out on the hotel terrace and looked around for them. He was too mad to leave as much money as Marshall Field, he said.
That's all very well.
Baby was right, and she knew it. Face to face, her father would have it on almost any clergyman.
They were an American ducal family without a title. The very name written in a hotel register, signed to an introduction, used in a difficult situation, caused a psychological metamorphosis in people. And in return, this change had crystallized her own sense of position. She knew these facts from the English, who had known them for over 200 years, but she did not know that twice Dick had come close to flinging the marriage in her face. All that saved it this time was Nicole finding their table and glowing away, white and fresh and new in the September afternoon.
"How do you do, lawyer? We're going to Como tomorrow for a week and then back to Zurich. That's why I wanted you and sister to settle this, because it doesn't matter to us how much I'm allowed. We're going to live very quietly in Zurich for 2 years, and Dick has enough to take care of us. No, baby, I'm more practical than you think. It's only for clothes and things I'll need it. Why, that's more than... Can the estate really afford to give me all that? I know I'll never manage to spend it. Do you have that much? Why do you have more? Is it because I'm supposed to be incompetent? All right, let my share pile up then. No, Dick refuses to have anything whatever to do with it. I'll have to feel bloated for us both. Baby, you have no more idea of what Dick is like than... Now, where do I sign? Oh, I'm sorry. Isn't it funny and lonely being together, Dick? No place to go except close. Shall we just love and love? Ah, but I love the most. And I can tell when you're away from me, even a little. I think it's wonderful to be just like everybody else, to reach out and find you all warm beside me in the bed. If you will kindly call my husband at the hospital, yes, the little book is selling everywhere. They want it published in 6 languages. I was to do the French translation, but I'm tired these days. I'm afraid of falling. I'm so heavy and clumsy, like a broken roly-poly that can't stand up straight. The cold stethoscope against my heart, and my strongest feeling, je m'en fiche de tout. Oh, that poor woman in the hospital with the blue baby, much better dead. Isn't it fine there are 3 of us now? That seems unreasonable, Dick. We have every reason for taking the bigger apartment. Why should we penalize ourselves just because there's more Warren money than Diver money? Oh, thank you, Camelier. But we've changed our minds. This English clergyman tells us that your wine here in Orvieto is excellent. It doesn't travel? That must be why we have never heard of it, because we love wine. The lakes are sunk in the brown clay, and the slopes have all the creases of a belly. The photographer gave us the picture of me, my hair limp over the rail on the boat to Capri. Goodbye, blue grotte, sang the boatman. Come again soon. And afterward, tracing down the hot, sinister shin of the Italian boot, with the wind soughing around those eerie castles, the dead watching from up on those hills. This ship is nice, with our heels hitting the deck together. This is the blowy corner, and each time we turn it, I slant forward against the wind and pull my coat together without losing step with Dick. We are chanting nonsense. Oh, 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 other flamingos than me.
Oh, 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 other flamingos than me. Life is fun with Dick. The people in deck chairs look at us, and a woman is trying to hear what we're singing. Dick is tired of singing it, so go on alone, Dick. You will walk differently alone, dear, through a thicker atmosphere, forcing your way through the shadows of chairs, through the dripping smoke of the funnels. You will feel your own reflection sliding along the eyes of those who look at you. You are no longer insulated. But I suppose you must touch life in order to spring from it. Sitting on the stanchion of this lifeboat, I look seaward and let my hair blow and shine. I am motionless against the sky, and the boat is made to carry my form onward into the blue obscurity of the future. I am Pallas Athene, carved reverently on the front of a galley. The waters are lapping in the public toilets, and the agate-green foliage of spray changes and complains about the stern. We traveled a lot that year, from Woolloomoolloo Bay to Biskra. On the edge of the Sahara, we ran into a plague of locusts, and the chauffeur explained kindly that they were bumblebees. The sky was low at night, full of the presence of a strange and watchful god. Oh, the poor little naked Uled Nail. The night was noisy with drums from Senegal and flutes and whining camels, and the natives pattering about in shoes made of old automobile tires. But I was gone again by that time. Trains and beaches, they were all one. That was why he took me traveling, but after my second child, my little girl, Topsy, was born, everything got dark again. If I could get word to my husband, who has seen fit to desert me here, to leave me in the hands of incompetence. You tell me my baby is black. That's farcical. That's very cheap. We went to Africa merely to see Timgad, since my principal interest in life is archaeology. I am tired of knowing nothing and being reminded of it all the time. When I get well, I want to be a fine person like you, Dick. I would study medicine, except it's too late. We must spend my money and have a house. I'm tired of apartments and waiting for you. You're bored with Zurich, and you can't find time for writing here, and you say that it's a confession of weakness for a scientist not to write. And I'll look over the whole field of knowledge and pick out something and really know about it, so I'll have it to hang on to if I go to pieces again. You'll help me, Dick, so I won't feel so guilty. We'll live near a warm beach, where we can be brown and young, together. This is going to be Dick's workhouse. Oh, the idea came to us both at the same moment. We had passed Tarm a dozen times, and we rode up here and found the houses empty, except two stables. When we bought, we acted through a Frenchman, but the Navy sent spies up here in no time when they found that Americans had bought part of a hill village. They looked for cannons all through the building material, and finally Baby had to twitch wires for us at the Affaires Étrangères in Paris. No one comes to the Riviera in summer, so we expect to have a few guests, and to work. There are some French people here. Miss Tanguay last week, surprised to find the hotel open. And Picasso, and the man who wrote Pas sur la bouche. Dick, why did you register Mr. and Mrs. Diver instead of Dr. and Mrs. Diver? I just wondered. It just floated through my mind. You've taught me that work is everything, and I believe you. You used to say a man knows things, and when he stops knowing things, he's like anybody else. And the thing is to get power before he stops knowing things. If you want to turn things topsy-turvy, all right, but must your Nicole follow you, walking on her hands, darling? Tommy says I am silent. Since I was well, the first time I talked a lot to Dick late at night, both of us sitting up in bed and lighting cigarettes, then diving down afterward out of the blue dawn and into the pillows, to keep the light from our eyes. Sometimes I sing and play with the animals. And I have a few friends, too. Mary, for instance. When Mary and I talk, neither of us listens to the other. Talk is men. When I talk, I say to myself that I am probably Dick. Already I have even been my son, remembering how wise and slow he is. Sometimes I am Dr. Domler. And one time I may even be an aspect of you, Tommy Barbon. Tommy is in love with me, I think, but gently, reassuringly. Enough, though, so that he and Dick have begun to disapprove of each other. All in all, everything has never gone better. I am among friends who like me. I am here on this tranquil beach with my husband and two children. Everything is all right. If I can finish translating this damn recipe for chicken a la Maryland into French. My toes feel warm in the sand. Yes, I'll look. More new people. Oh, that girl, yes. Who did you say she looked like? No, I haven't. We don't get much chance to see the new American pictures over here. Rosemary who? Well, we're getting very fashionable for July. Seems very peculiar to me. Yes, she's lovely. But there can be too many people.
This ends Disc 6.